Today is August the 2nd. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, and we're in the studio of PRN. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and its live stream on the Internet on WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Podcast of the program is available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will continue to be available on PRN.FM. Tonight, WBAI is in membership drive, and I'll be on at 9 p.m. Eastern Time with a different program. And Joe, I'm glad to have you in the studio with me.
Well, it's good to be back down here with you, Hank. I'd like to point out one thing for those folks who are not used to the podcast and they'd like to subscribe to it. There's two ways they can do that. They can subscribe to it on iTunes until Apple decides not to do that. But they can also go to our website and download the RSS file and subscribe to it there.
And once again, our website is PCRadioshow.org. There are a couple of important things that happened the last week. Let's talk about something called Paint. You know, Paint was a functional utility that appeared in Windows 1 back in 1985.
Microsoft Paint.
Microsoft Paint,
other
right.
Ones.
And it was 1985, and after 32 years, they dropped it 2 weeks ago. And, of course, there was a huge outcry and say, wait a minute, don't you realize people use it? And it actually is quite useful. And the reason why people started using it is because in Windows 10, they had the print screen. All you had to do was hold down the Windows key, hit print screen, and you get a JPEG right away. You don't have to fool around with a clipboard or anything at all.
It goes right into Paint, and you can start manipulating it.
And they brought it back, and a lot of people saying, why are they going through this thing called deprecation? And I know that Joe was looking up and saying, what the heck is deprecation? Now, withdrawal of software, that you know. In other words, they're dropping it. That's a simple term.
No, but deprecation doesn't mean that. It means it's no longer being recommended.
Yeah, but then it was not. They also said that they were not including in the general release of Windows 10 from that point on.
Because it was deprecated.
Well, no, actually, they said that it was put in deprecation only the last couple of days. And, you know, people wonder, why is Microsoft doing it? It's very simple. I remember in the early days of programming, as a Fortran programmer, basically Fortran meant formula translation, and you write a program, and as a scientific programmer, it was all formulas. And you just stick the formula in, and you get this big chunk of code that say, you know, if A squared plus B squared equals C squared, you know, and all that business. And what happened was that you get this big chunk of code, and reason is because it's a Fortran library, and everything in the library is pulled into the program, and it points to the different parts of it, and it loads up the parameters, and, you get the results. Now, what happened was that in the 60s, as machines got to be smaller and companies, smaller than banks and universities were getting computers. They didn't have all that storage. So what IBM did was they said, okay, when you need it, as you write the program, we'll make it part of the program. But if you're not calling for it, we won't do it. So if you think about it, in many ways, that's like Windows 10. Windows 10 started off as actually, let's talk about Windows 7. Windows 7 actually is a very well-received operating system. And when they came up with 10, they said, you know what? We want to put Windows 10 on the tablets and smartphones. But the size of Windows 7, how do you reduce the size of it? And everyone has all these functions. So what they did was they took the least used code, at least what they thought the least used code was, and they condensed it. Or compressed it, and when they compress it, it means that every time you call for that function, it has to expand. And of course, that was easy. I mean, someone said to me, does Windows 10 run as fast as Windows 7? The answer was very simple, no, because you had to go through compression and expansion each time.
The compression and decompression is not an unusual way of handling code. All of these people who complained about the DLLs with Windows 95 That's really basically all they were talking about, is if you needed a piece of code, it would be called in, and if you didn't need it, it wouldn't be called in. The problem there was different people renamed the DLL files different names, and the programs got confused.
One of the things I you know, this is really a forerunner of what Microsoft will be doing. Do not be surprised that they start either withdraw or they go through deprecation, or basically not included in the general release of Windows 10, because they got to fit it into the tablets where, well, let me tell you what happened, okay? Black Friday was late last year, around Thanksgiving. I bought a machine. I bought a Dell 11-inch unit, portable unit, brand new, $99. And I said, heck, I can use that. But it only came with 32 gig of storage. And after I loaded up the very basic stuff I needed, I had something like 5-6 gig of storage available that I can use. And then when the and all these updates came in, especially with the latest one, I'm down to 3 gigs of storage. So now what I had to do was I had to then say, what can I run with? So I decided to move a lot of my subdirectory of the operating system onto the micro SD chip slot. So I got a 64 gigs chip, and I put it in. And I know that one of the things that Joe was asking me is, what speed chip? I says, well, in my case, I bought a SanDisk because I knew that SanDisk had the higher speed. I could have bought a very low-cost micro SD chip, but, you know, you have no idea what the speeds are.
I called up Hank the other day. I had gotten a piece of spam in my email offering me chips at what looked to be a pretty good price. I got, and I haven't received them yet, but I got a 64 gig, a 128 gig, and a 256 gig, all three of them for $4. Not each, total.
Now, wait a minute. Isn't one of the things we tell people is, if it's too good to be true, it's not true?
Absolutely.
But there's a sucker born every minute.
I felt I could invest $4 to find out how the scam really worked. But the point being that last year I saw a similar deal on USB drives, and I bought a terabyte drive for $10. And I pointed out to Hank that it ran at about one-tenth the speed of my other terabyte drives.
Well, I think there's another point that I want to bring up, is that other than the fact that as Windows 10 go through updates, they're going to have to look very hard about the, you know, eliminating some of this stuff. One of the things I was very surprised that they left off was the system image backup module. And what they recommend is use a third party.
Well, it happened that we did a show not too long ago on a third party. I've been using it since then. It's pretty good.
I know. And so
why don't we tell them what it was?
Acronis. Now, there was a piece of email that was flying around with Michael Horowitz and Joe and myself. And I knew what the answer was. And people don't realize that if you happen to have a Mac, well, the Mac runs a little differently. You can actually take programs that are running on a Mac and just move it to another Mac OS X machine, and it'll run. You can't do that with a Windows program, because when you install the Windows program, the operating parameters go into the registry area, and they're tied together. So if you just move the program without modifying the registry, it won't run.
But there is a third-party program that will do that for you.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not 100%, okay?
No, actually,
it's not. The reason why it's not 100% is that it relies on default areas where they expect the information to be, and some of these applications, they go off on their own. And So one of the things I just want to tell people is that with Windows, if you want to move to a different Windows operating system, like 7 to 10, and you say, gee, I don't want to go through the upgrade process. I want to just, you know, I bought a brand new machine. It's a Windows 10, and I got, let's say, Office running on 7, and I want to move it over. And not that simple. Unless you just go get another license.
Or?
You do an upgrade, and then... Well, you know what? Either you know how to do it, or you just say, I'm not going to do it.
Okay, the point being that you can do it. You can do it with third-party software. You can do it yourself. but it's certainly not for the faint of heart.
Now, the other thing that Microsoft has announced in their own fashion is that they say that starting with updates, if you happen to have the Atom processor, don't be surprised if you can no longer do updates, but the security fixes they'll still do, okay? And they've been very...
Hank, is there a technically good reason for that, or is it just simply to force you to upgrade your machine?
Well, you know, the inference is that the code that is used or the instruction sets that are needed is not in the Atom processor. Baloney. That's not the answer, okay? Reason is very simple. In many ways, as you start updating the operating system, and especially with Windows 10, it going through the compression and the expansion, it's going to run slower and slower and slower, and it just makes the operating system look, you know, as poor performance. And they want you to move over to the, I mean, let's face it, the more modern modern processors.
But this has always been the case. I have an old laptop that came installed with Windows XP. And after a while, it got kind of old-fashioned, and I had a legitimate copy of Windows 7, so I installed it on that machine. I added a little bit of memory, I added some other things, and I now had a laptop with Windows 7, which was probably the slowest laptop in human captivity.
Well, actually, I have the same unit you have, Joe, and it started, as you said, with XP. I put a licensed copy of Windows 7 on it. It ran fine, and it was very acceptable. And then I converted it to, I upgraded to Windows 10, and it was slower, let's face it. It was slower, but it was acceptable. And with each update, it got slower and slower. And I'm fine with that. You know what I use that machine for? Downloading. This way, you know, with the modern day of downloading, is you have to be very careful because they stick you with things that... you know, they trick you into downloading things.
Well,
now the worst part is they don't even trick you anymore. They just give it to you whether you like it or not.
Well, a lot of them just give it to you. And then the other thing is that a lot of them use bad grammar. So you think you're saying no, but you're really saying yes.
Well, I just, you know. Now, the other thing that happened last week, I think that is of great importance, is that Apple has removed the VPN apps from the App Store in China, and I know that you had...
I want to talk about this. First of all, in China, it's illegal to use any program that will bypass the Chinese firewall and the Chinese regulation.
What do you mean by firewall now?
It's a blockage. It's an international... It's a blockage of international sites. In China, you cannot just automatically say you want to go to www.mysite.com. Unless that's one of the approved sites, it's blocked. It's blocked by the ISP. It's blocked by the DNS. But basically what I'm saying is it's blocked by China. They do not have what we call freedom of the press or freedom of speech. The other thing that is more important, though, is whether or not the VPN you actually download will violate the law. Because I've discovered that so many VPNs are not what they propose that they are.
They don't work the way you think they work.
Well, for example, I called up Michael because he knows a lot more about it than I do. I'm really quite naive when it comes to VPNs. And I said, is it true that this particular VPN, I mentioned a name, does not have the number of servers in the countries that they said they do, which is what the article I read said? And Michael said, not just them. You can't really trust a great many of the VPNs out there. And then he went on to say to me, here's a site that reviews them, and here's another site that reviews them, and you can't trust what's in the reviews. It's a wild west out there. I finally came across a VPN, and it looked really legitimate. I read all the reviews and everything, and I called up Michael, and he said, try it. It sounds good.
Well, you know, the term he used, and it's sort of like synonymous with other things you've heard, fake servers.
Well, fake servers and fake news and fake this and fake that have been around for a long time. We've I don't want to get into why it's changed its meaning or its intent, but first of all, Michael will suggest that if it's a free VPN, the odds are very good that what they claim are not true. It's not saying in every case, just very good. If you're going with a commercial VPN, which is what I would recommend, and you check its references and you read its reviews and it all sounds very wonderful, before you do anything that's dangerous, check it out carefully, research it on your own, test it out. How are you going to do that? I don't really know. I can't give you advice on that. The one that I finally chose, I have not fully tested out yet. When I do, I'll be happy to announce it here on the air.
Well, let's get back to the original story about VPN in China. What's to prevent the a user in China to just go to a non-Chinese site?
That's where the great firewall of China comes in. They can't do that. They're blocked.
Well,
unless they had a VPN.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. They can make long-distance calls, right? So if they can make long-distance calls, why can't they then just...
I think you will find, Hank, and I can't attest to this from personal knowledge, but that long-distance calls are not direct dialed. They go through an exchange.
What about VoIP calls?
That's a good question, and I don't know.
VoIP calls are really on the Internet.
But I'll tell you one thing. In a country like China, and not just China, but many other countries around the world, I don't want to do anything that the government considers illegal because they have a funny way of getting even with you. They throw you in jail for a couple of hundred years.
Hey, Joe, so if you disappear, you disappear. I know where you went, okay? Hey, Joe, I have
Wait a minute. You don't care if I disappear?
Well, I would call it's a magic act, you know, and then I bring you back.
Los desperados in Argentina wouldn't agree. All right, another
story. Hey, Joe, I want to cover one more thing, okay? And that's the fact that TSA's got new regulations that they are putting in.
Oh, yeah, and I'm going to find out in a couple of weeks whether or not
and
it's true.
What they're saying is that now you have to pull out all the electronic equipment you have that's greater than bigger than a cell phone.
But how big is a cell phone, Hank?
That's a good question because some of these cell phones are bigger than small tablets.
My small tablet now has a program on it that lets me interact with my cell phone so I can use the tablet as a cell phone.
Well, one of the things I brought up to you is suppose I have a charger for a digital camera. Do I have to pull that out? The answer probably is yes.
My guess is here's the thing, Hank. They pass these regulations as if they know what they're doing. And the people who have to affect the regulations then behave as if they know what they're doing. So you have the blind leading the lame, leading the dumb. I don't know. Let me tell you that the state of Israel has had magnificent security on their national airline since the day it was invented, and they have none of the problems that we have with the TSA.
Well, it's going to be interesting. The reason why I say that is because if you have all that electronics equipment, you got to pull it out piece by piece, and you can't cover it, you can't have anything under it, and then it goes through this, the big machine they have, and you have no access to it, and you just hope it comes out that no one has taken the wrong, a bin.
Well, the so-called x-rays or fluoroscopies that they use are the whole thing just, you know what they should do? They should make you sign in for the airline that you want to go on 1 week in advance, and then they can individually inspect each person and pass the... Hank, it's yours.
You know what? I'm going to take the Amtrak. By the way, we have a couple of very interesting segments to present to you, and I think you're going to find it of great interest because David Perry had done an interview with the vice president of McAfee Labs. And it's interesting what they're doing because we no longer think of malware as just antivirus anymore. It's a heck of a lot more than that. And it should be quite interesting. So let's get to it right now. Microsoft product withdrawal and deprecation. One of the oldest programming languages, Fortran, was developed by a team of programmers at IBM and was first published in 1957. The name Fortran is an acronym for formula translation, because it was designed to allow easy translation of math formulas into code. Fortran was a popular scientific programming language. The runtime of a created program was, however, quite large, as a subroutine library was part of each written program. In computer programming, a subroutine is a sequence of program instructions that perform a specific task, packaged as a unit. Subprograms may be defined within programs, or separately in libraries that can be used by other programs. As computer systems migrated onto smaller systems, memory and storage were limiting factors. Compiled programs then only pulled in reference programs when actually used. In many ways, there is a similarity with how Windows have evolved and developed. Windows 1.0 was released in November of 1985. It was the first version of the Microsoft Windows operating system. As it developed with each new version, memory storage requirements increased. Fast forward to 2015. We now see that Windows 10 consists partially of compressed code. At runtime, function needed is expanded if it is compressed, each time it is loaded into memory. Seldom used utilities and functions are compressed, but often called functions are not compressed to minimize additional runtime requirements during program execution. The reason for this is to enable Windows 10 to fit into tablets and smart telephones in which flash memory is very limited in an operating system. In an operating system, you want to package it to handle all anticipated program control. Last Thanksgiving, on Black Friday, there were many systems sold at insanely low prices, but if you were to review the specifications carefully, you would note that the total storage available was only 32 gigabytes. With the installation of Windows 10, less than half of the available 32 gigabyte storage was available for application installation and data storage. I have such a unit, and by the time I completed the setup configuration, I had only 5 gigabytes left for any meaningful work. But Windows 10 release 1607 took away even some more of that, and now that Windows 10 build 1703 has been released, I'm down to about 3 gigabytes of usable storage. Microsoft is aware that with each update, more storage is needed, so they have announced a number of utilities will no longer be a part of the Windows 10 general release. Some of the utilities were dropped altogether, and others were deprecated. That's a fancy word for it's available from Microsoft, but it's from the Microsoft Store, and if you need it, it can be downloaded and be included into your operating system. 2 weeks ago, Microsoft announced Paint, which was included in the original Windows 1 operating system, will not be available. The user community objections were loud and clear, and Microsoft heard it. Paint will now be part of the Microsoft operating system, but it's only available from the Microsoft Store, and you have to download it first. We can expect many other parts of Windows 10 operating system to be dropped or be available only from the Microsoft Store. What I have done was to install a 64 gigabyte micro SD chip for storage. I moved my documents, my downloads, picture, and music subdirectories onto external storage. How does all this affect Windows 10 performance? For me, it was acceptable. What the heck, I got a new 11.3-inch Dell notebook for $99 on Black Friday.
This is David Perry. I'm at Black Hat in Las Vegas, and with me is Vincent Weaver. Vincent, how do you do?
How are you doing? Doing very well today.
All right. And your job description is exactly what? You've been a lot of different things over the years that I've known you.
I have been. I've been a researcher and engineer, but today I run McAfee Labs, so I'm actually vice president of McAfee Labs.
Interesting. So you're the vice president of McAfee Labs. Now, McAfee Labs is no longer part of Intel at this point?
McAfee is a wholly independent company. We broke out of Intel, and we're now delivering our services to both consumers and corporate under the McAfee brand as an independent security company.
Now, when I started at McAfee, John McAfee was still there, but things have changed a lot since those days.
Things have changed hugely. Obviously, our whole environment has changed in terms of way back then you were dealing with Windows XP, today we're with Windows 10, we're all dealing with mobile devices, we've all got smart devices in our homes, we're dealing with IoT, and the technologies in terms of protection technologies have moved on. We're not just dealing with antivirus software anymore, we're dealing with machine learning, analytics, behavioral aspects, exploit protection. So we've evolved a lot over the last 20 years.
That's a good place to start. As the computing environment has evolved, the threat landscape has co-evolved along with it, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. So if we go back into the 80s and 90s, you really saw the old wannabes, the original hackers, the virus writers. And in the early 2000s, we saw the evolution of the cyber criminals, people who got involved for profit. And that kind of raised not just the people involved in it, but the type of tools that it trade.
I've been pointing out this out to people. That doesn't mean that the hackers went away.
No, absolutely. We still have multiple different groups there. We have people who like to experiment and try ideas out. The original idea of a hacker, somebody who likes to investigate and understand how things work and how things break. You got the crackers, or the criminal people, and they're heavily influenced. When we talk about the threat landscape today in terms of ransomware, these are often the groups behind us. And then you got state actors coming in, where people are coming in, training people for cyber defense, cyber offensive techniques, and that's raising the bar in terms of tools and techniques that are available to a lot of the criminals today.
Well, I'd say you're short two of my groups. I put that in six silos, and the other two groups I have are hacktivists, okay, and corporations.
Absolutely. And the hacktivists, we see them coming out every couple of years. A couple of years ago, we had a lot of the anonymous attacks. If we look back last year, we had a lot of attacks against central banks. There was a targeted campaign that was against 120 banks around the world as part of an anti-financial institute. It was a hacktivism type of campaign. We see web defacements all the time. We see a lot of activities. Again, their primary goal here is really for a social or economic or political message rather than profit or rather than state assets. And the last grouping in terms of corporations, of course, again, it does positive and negatives. Positive because it trains a lot of cyber defenders. The tools of trade are kind of learned there and people go for us. But also corporations need to defend themselves, and they're also involved in driving the state of the art in terms of defense tools.
Okay, so let's say you're talking, because you are, you're talking to the man on the street in this radio show. What should they be on the lookout for? Where is their are their interests most impinged by state actors, by hacktivists, by criminals, by any of it? What should they be on the lookout for? What are they protecting?
So the good news in all of the complex stories we weave around what's happening on a global political stage is, as an individual, you're about protecting your data, your assets, your information. So you're still basically looking at, what am I most sensitive? Online banking. I want to protect my passwords, my information. I want to protect my systems, not just in terms of the PC, but you're also talking about mobile devices. And increasingly, we're talking about cloud services. If I store all my sensitive photographs or all my sensitive documents in a cloud service, I want to know it's secured up there as well. So the basics are the basics. Make sure that you're using the best protection you can. Make sure you're setting and using the opportunity for things like passwords, whether it's a biometric one, whether it's a number or a name you use. Leverage it to the maximum extent. When you're taking technology, particularly into your home these days, make sure you're configuring them properly. Don't just keep with the default password that comes with it. Make sure you're actually taking the time to actually configure the security of the systems and lock them. I think we all recognize that with Wi-Fi today, but we often forget the other smart devices coming into our home.
All right. We've recently seen examples where smart light bulbs were used as a point of entry to invade a secure network in a corporation.
We've seen many examples of this, from office automation systems, routers systems. And of course, it's about ourselves, but we're also working corporations. We can become the targets of an entry into a corporation we work for, and we see many examples of that. On the flip side, if we go back to Mirai attack, which was last year, where the attack was a distributed denial of service attack, they were using a lot of unsecured smart devices around their homes. So again, we could be part of an attack on somebody else if we don't secure our own assets.
Right. When I asked you what people are protecting, you said their data, their access to their bank accounts and things like that. I also want to point out that you are protecting your access in general, because you might be a side target to your brother-in-law who works at the Pentagon or something.
Absolutely. And one of the things we're seeing increasingly is we call them supply chain attacks, which is it's really hard to attack a really leading edge corporation today. So what they'll do is they'll look and see who are the contractors, the suppliers, who works for them. It's easier to go after maybe a financial officer in a company than it's to go after the company themselves. If they're working from home, have they secured their system? And we do see these advanced attacks leveraging home users working from home or systems or even small mom and pop stores where there seem to be easier targets in order to break into the larger organization.
Right. My favorite bugaboo is that I say that we need better education of the end users. And we've got a conference coming up in Vienna at the end of the summer at the UN to talk about this. The question is McAfee positioning itself to educate the end users for how to better leverage their cyber world for security?
The answer is yes, because it's not just a technology story. We'll make our technology smarter and better and more capable, and certainly in the enterprise size, much more sophisticated in what it can do. We've also got a duty to help educate users, all the way from the K-12 level in terms of kids as they're coming up. Obviously, there's things that they've looked at us in terms of, you know, sexting, extortion, and other things that they've come across. So basic best practices around cybersecurity, cyber safety. We've also got a duty to try and make our technology easier to use. So if people are finding it so difficult to use passwords, can we offer them alternatives? TrueKey is a technology we use, which is about password management, making it safer. When we were part of Intel, we did a lot of work on biometrics in terms of facial recognition. So there's a lot of areas we can help the average person make security a little bit easier, but you're still relying on them to take the time and effort to do so.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question that frequently comes up on this show that I'm sure you're going to have fun hearing this question, but isn't what I get from Microsoft for free enough? Isn't that enough protection?
That's a great question, and the answer is no, it's not good enough. When we're looking at today's world of cybersecurity, it's very advanced. We're looking at some of the advanced exploit tools, which hit consumers. It's not just enterprises. And so you've constantly got to evolve your technology. So today we don't talk about antivirus only. We talk about exploit protection. We talk about dynamic containment. We talk about machine learning analytics. We talk about static analysis. We talk about behavioral analysis. There's a whole gauntlet of things which go into the modern cybersecurity. So when you're using a plain vanilla solution, it's not sufficient for what you need. By all means, use it. There's no problem there. But you need better protection. You need more than that onto your system.
What I like about McAfee's approach recently in the last couple of years is that most of the other big players in this marketplace have placed themselves solid behind one technology. For example, some company that we won't name would say it's all about reputation services. Somebody else would say it's all about whitelisting. I take a look at McAfee. McAfee's using those things, but you're using everything you can get your hands on.
We firmly believe in that, because if we look at our technology stack, it's actually evolved a lot. Now, from a consumer point of view, our goal is to make it easier and the highest performance products we can. So a lot of that is hidden. But the techniques we use today are combinations of reputation, cloud, behavioral, static analysis, machine learning analytics, exploit protection, and all of these are kind of under the hood. So it's like looking at a modern car. You've got multiple different components all working together. If it's done right, it actually looks and feels easier. And that's our philosophy. Certainly on the enterprise side, we've always been famous for APO, the manageability of our technology. How do you deploy it? How to maintain this? Because again, security that's not manageable is not very effective. So keeping at the usability, making sure the performance is there, but pack that system with the most advanced security solutions we can will always be our philosophy.
Does a consumer see something similar to an APO in the McAfee world?
Consumers generally don't need an APO, because APO is about managing multiple systems, typically in a corporate environment. So you might use it in, say, a small business or office. But if I've only got one machine or two machines, I don't really need a management system. However, we've also got something coming out called a home gateway solution, where we're partnering with people providing routers and systems. And there you're actually talking about managing your house, your environment. The notion of being able to say, look, I may have a primary PC, but I also got kids using an iPad, an iPhone, an Android system, and I want to know that they're updated and protected. And actually, we do provide that through a web interface, a much simpler form of interacting to give that level of control and visibility.
I was going to ask that next, because what's very interesting is we've got a world where frequently what's failing in your home network is the router, because the cable company doesn't come up and update you every time that they should. So you're partnering with people. You're going to make sure that that router stays up to date as well.
We're partnering with technology companies out there to make sure our software can power their solutions. And if you think of your home, it's not just about whether the router is configured or set up, but are the systems, can I identify what I have in my home? Today, I've got about 60 IP addresses in my system. So I need to know, is it a TiVo box, is it an entertainment box, is it a security camera? And then, am I seeing the behavior I should see? So if my security camera suddenly tries to send tons of traffic out to the Pentagon, clearly something is going wrong. It's a DDoS attack. So we can actually see that, and we can address this, and we can provide the controls and protection around that. Again, making it as simple as possible for the average person to understand what's in their home, and how to secure us.
That's an awful lot of information. If people wanted to learn more, should they just go to McAfee.com?
The best way of finding out more is come to McAfee.com, go to the consumer information pages. You will see our solutions, our information, and all of our taught leadership or education materials are all available there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Vincent. I hope we can have you on the show in the future.
Very good talking to you. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, David.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Let's start off by talking about heart failure. Now, a lot of people misunderstand what this is about because the name's misleading. It doesn't mean your heart has failed. It just means that it's no longer able to pump blood efficiently. When this happens, fluid builds up in your body, first of all in your legs and other tissues, but eventually it starts to fill up your lungs and you have trouble breathing, and if left untreated, it results in a crisis and you have to be rushed to the hospital to get rid of the excess fluid so you can breathe again. Well, researchers have come up with a way to help monitor patients, heart failure patients who have been released from the hospital, to make sure that they're still doing well. They're using radar to do this. Now, that's kind of a freaky thing to do, but it really makes a lot of sense. What they've designed is a vest. It's like a half vest that a patient puts on in their own home and wears it for a few minutes. It uses radio waves, radio frequency emissions, to take readings from the body, and it checks how much fluid is present. If there's too much fluid present, then they know to alert healthcare workers who can come out and help adjust the patient's medications and, you know, give them a quick check of their vital signs and get them back on the right track again long before things reach a crisis and they have to be readmitted to the hospital, which is inconvenient at the least and extremely expensive at the worst. So this is something to be avoided. The device was created by researchers at the Ohio State University Wexler Medical Center. It's now in a clinical trial to see how much help this device can give patients who've been discharged. And the early data that's come in so far has shown a remarkable 87% reduction in hospital readmissions just during the first 3 months that it was used. So that's 9 out of 10 hospital readmissions have been avoided thanks to using this device. And again, it's a simple thing that patients can do on their own in their home, and the data is automatically forwarded to the physicians and other healthcare workers. It's a pretty cool device and could go a long way to help heart failure patients live a better life and help our healthcare system save an enormous amount of money in the process. There's a lot of talk these days about artificial intelligence and machine learning and computers figuring out stuff on their own. And it's pretty exciting and maybe a little bit scary kind of stuff. But here's a story from the world of medicine that shows some of the power of these new technologies and the surprising results that they can produce. There was a study called Look Ahead that was studying 5,000 overweight and obese patients, looking at their history, and these patients all had type 2 diabetes. And the goal was to track them for up to 13 years and see if moderate weight loss could reduce their mortality rates and help avoid some of the serious complications that often come along with diabetes, such as heart attacks and strokes. The program was funded by the National Institutes of Health, NIH, but it was cut off early because the results showed that there was no evidence of reduced cardiovascular events if the patients were involved in weight loss programs. That's where the story would end normally. but a bunch of data science researchers at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai decided to take a second look at the data. They used an artificial intelligence system that used machine learning to look at all this patient history and see if they could find some correlations that weren't immediately obvious. The fascinating thing was this new analysis was able to identify a specific subgroup of the patients that did not respond the same way to the weight reduction program as the rest of the patients did. For 15% of them, the weight loss program actually led to worse health outcomes. So once this system was able to identify the subgroup and separate the results for the two groups, they were then able to find that patients who responded to the weight loss program showed great gains. And it was only the negative results from this smaller group, about 15% of the total, those were the ones that drew down the overall results to make it look like there was no benefit. And so this is a really significant finding. In addition to this, however, they were able to identify the characteristics of these subgroups. They tended to be patients whose diabetes were mild or well-controlled. They tended to have a negative view of their own health. They were in poor compliance with the exercise program, and they had lower improvement in other areas such as their mental health and blood pressure. So now doctors can identify which of their diabetes patients are less likely to benefit from a weight loss program, all because these computers were given an opportunity to take a second look at the data that human researchers had looked at and said there was no useful information there. American Sign Language is used throughout the U.S. by those who are deaf and those who interact with those people who are deaf. One problem is that if you don't know the sign language, you can't communicate with people. This is why interpreters are provided in settings such as courtrooms and other places. So some researchers at the University of California, San Diego, decided to try to work out a machine way of translating American Sign Language. To start with, they've made the task easier by focusing on just fingerspelling. That's where you hold your hand in different positions to signal specific letters, and so you can spell words out. It's a little slower than using the symbols that are used for whole words, but it's a way that American Sign Language users use to spell things out when they don't have a word for a sign for the word that they're trying to convey. The interesting thing about this is the researchers created a wireless glove that senses the position of the fingers and the hand, but they managed to do this using inexpensive, off-the-shelf, commercially available components. They started with a typical sports glove like you'd wear for golf or baseball. They used stretchable plastic that's flexible with a carbon coating to make it conductive. They used that as the sensors. They were able to determine whether or not each knuckle on each finger of the hand was straight or bent. Then they assigned binary values to each of those knuckles, 1 or 0, whether it's straight or bent. And by doing this, they were able to then assign a total value to each hand position. Different letters would have a different value because the fingers would be bent differently. There are some letters that end up signaling the same value. So they've also added accelerometers to detect motion and pressure sensors so that they can distinguish between these similar letters, such as I or J. Then this data is sent by Bluetooth to an application on a smartphone or tablet, which will then show the letters as they're being spelled out. So here's a fascinating use of sensors and existing technology to create a low-cost device that could help people who use American Sign Language communicate with those who don't. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
One of the things you learn when you're working with Hank is that backup, backup, backup might also seem to read like your table of contents on segments on his show. I'm going to get away from that this week. I'm building a 40-year cybernetic house. 40yearhouse.com is a touch point for some information. But what makes it cybernetic is a network of controllers, also on the network, thousands of sensors, also on the network, more than 100 actuators, but I really want to stick with the controllers. Most of them, 50, 60, 70 of them, are connected over the same network, Raspberry Pi 3 Model B computers. And that leads to some concerns that I've done some homework about recently, and I think we've got some answers. One of the concerns with a Raspberry Pi 3 Model B is that you can't just normally switch it on and off without causing corruption to data and maybe the file system on its SD memory card. A couple of ways around that. In order to get a clean shutdown, you have to issue a command. It's, something like sudo shutdown minus H, something of the sort. I have not done my testing on it yet, but I believe there are a few components out there, I've located a couple, that can track the 5-volt power feed to the Raspberry Pi and set a trigger point, maybe 4.8 volts. If that power ever drops below 4.8, I can send a signal to one of the GPIO, general purpose input output pins, that then makes a thread run to issue the command to shut it down. Now, when will that happen? Hopefully never. These things are on UPSs. There's a backup generator that the UPS should be able to bridge until that power is available. And beyond that, the power lines have 1,000 microfarad capacitors. Brief outages would be invisible with a capacitor providing load for that brief section of a second during which most outages happen. Still, it's something you want to avoid. So a hardware approach triggering a software command to shut it down, replicated almost 100 times across the network, is one way to deal with that. And if you guys are working with Raspberry Pi, something you may want to investigate. I've seen some early experimental work online. You can find it easily enough. There's another approach I like even more. And let's back off a little bit. All of the prototyping we're doing, most of the development we're doing, is in Python. Python is an interpretive language. The Raspberry Pi has 1 gig of RAM. I've got 32 gig SD cards on these things. I wanted to have a lot of space because if you get bad sectors, the SD card will move them and that will erode ultimately your total capacity. So having way too much capacity is a cheap way to help the SD card stay viable for a longer time. And we are looking for a longer time. That said, if we can develop code that is compilable, and move sections of code, like functions, or just call them modules, into a compiled language, we could potentially shrink the amount of code that has to run so that all of the operations, once loaded from, read from the SD card, are actually running in memory, running in RAM. And if we do that, then there will never be a moment when during shutdown, it's trying to write to the SD card, which should also dodge the bullet of that corruption of the file system or the file contents. These are two of the things I'm looking at. Now, please understand, networking that many anything is going to be a challenge. The speed of the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B, when attaching to a network, caps at 100 megabits per second. We're not dealing with that much data. 100 megabits per second is just fine. Remember, this is an intelligent node. This is a very smart little card, size of a deck of cards, but a very smart little card. So it can take the things that are connected to it, the sensors, the actuators, whatever's on there, and do a lot of processing to reduce the amount of data that ever has to be transacted across the network. It can pre-filter, it can make decisions, it can wait for incidents to happen. It's really cool how much smarts are on every node of the network, including distant far endpoints. It's very cool, but it's not enough to make it cybernetic. Dealing with the network means dealing with trying to remember where everybody is. I have a lot of the sensors dedicated to a heat map of the house, so we know where warm bodies are. I have a lot of sensors keeping an eye on the outdoor surveillance cameras and looking for motion detection. I have sensors looking at range detectors and all kinds of different things involving people coming into the driveway, into the garage, through the house, ringing doorbells. Oh, you name it. Even trying to put radar heads in so we know who's in bed and who isn't, whether they're awake or asleep, trying to figure out whether there's power flowing through the outlets to TV sets and things. Each little thing easy enough to work out. Each little thing fine, but unless you're coordinating the whole thing, and that would take one heck of a computer, unless you're coordinating the whole thing in a single bit of intelligence, you need some central, let's use the term spinal tap, some central silo of information. And if all you've got to work with is SD cards, 100 megabits, and Raspberry Pis across this part of the network, that silo of information doesn't fit natively. But again, after looking, we think we found an answer. And the answer is a fairly inexpensive network-attached storage, NAS drive, specifically a NAS drive in RAID 1, which is redundancy. With RAID 1, you've got two drives. They read and write at the same time. Everything that's on one drive is on the other drive. It is a mirror of the other drive. If one fails, the other maintains validity for a while until it too fails. And if one fails, it is announceable by the executive within the NAS so that a rebuild is either automatically done there or can happen elsewhere. Fine, so you've got this storage that isn't on the card, that isn't on, the only USB port on here is USB 2. We're not going to get a lot of throughput. All we've got is 100 meg Ethernet. We're not going to get tons of throughput. But it's really less about throughput than about being able to store weeks of memory, not just a log, but selective memory of things that are happening that are significant to any part of the system. Any part of the system can report to it. Any part of the system can get information from it. And in terms of very consistent with a Raspberry Pi's horsepower, that's a MySQL database. A MySQL database running on a Raspberry Pi and using a NAS drive as its storage silo becomes a fairly effective way to treat this diverse, spread out cluster of computers working on special tasks across many, 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 many little boards. There are 30 boards that do room related chores, including monitoring patterns that you might tap into a momentary light switch. There are some that are keeping a library of codes in case you've fallen asleep in bed and left the TV on. It knows how to send a signal through an IR blaster to turn that TV off. There are others that are keeping an eye on heat, on humidity, on pressure, on the status of the fire systems, on whether lights have been left on whether lights are off. It's just a question of, number one, making every part of the house need less maintenance, much less often. And number two, taking chores away, making it a much more comfy place to live. Is it cybernetic? Yeah, with the distributed intelligence, with the smart sensors, with the filtering happening at the ends of the nodes, and especially with that spinal memory, this does qualify as a cybernetic house. So I guess it's time to go back to Cybernetic Hank. It's all yours.
Thank you, Marty. The following are public service announcements on regional computer club meetings. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on drones Thursday, August the 3rd. That's tomorrow, 7 p.m. at the Keller William Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, number 101, White Plains, New York. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, August the 8th, 7:15 p.m., Russell Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting Thursday, August the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, the Silver Building, room 411, 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. And all these meetings are open to the public at no charge, no fee at all, and we hope to see you there. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.